Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next episode of Rooted Wisdom. This episode is all about CDFIs. These very important programs help those in Indian Country and other underrepresented areas access capital and grow their businesses. We will be speaking with Skaya Ducheneau, member of the Cheyenne River Lakota and executive director of Occuptan. She provides us with a wealth of information about the benefits of CDFIs and Occuptan's extraordinary history and future. Welcome, Skaya. Thank you for joining us on today's episode. Can you tell us a little bit about you and the company that you work for?
Absolutely. So my name is Skaya Ducheneau. I am the executive director of Occuptan. We're a native agriculture CDFI. CDFI is just Community Development Financial Institution. In short, I just like to say we're like a lender. We've got morals. We do technical assistance. We're a nonprofit lender in Eagle Butte, South Dakota, on the Cheyenne River Rez, but we finance native ag operations all across Indian Country. A little bit about me, though, is that I am born, raised, and enrolled Cheyenne River. I grew up on a commercial cow-calf operation on the east end of my res, in a little unincorporated town named Promise, Promise, South Dakota. And I grew up cattle ranching, and then, you know, I turned 18 and I knew everything. And I decided I never wanted to work that hard again a day in my life. So I went to school for business. I went and got my business degree because agriculture and business have, you know, nothing to do with each other, or so I thought at 18 when I was, you know, so wise.
Right.
So I went to school for business, and that wisdom lasted not even a year before I started really missing home and missing, you know, the culture of agriculture. Not necessarily the work part of it, but I really missed agriculture, the culture of agriculture, the people, the community, and stuff like that. Anyways, to make a long story short, I ended up back on my res with a cattle rancher, but this time I get to sit in a climate-controlled office. On the, you know, very hot days, I get to sit in the air conditioning, and on the very cold days, I get to sit in the heat, talking about cows. Fair weather cowgirl and a cowgirl out of necessity when I have to be, but I'm just a weekend warrior now, and I get to sit in my office during the week, and ended up doing exactly what I said I wouldn't do, but it was the best place to end up. So
you mentioned that Occuptan was a CDFI. How does a CDFI differ from traditional financial institutions?
The main difference is that CDFIs are, for the most part, a nonprofit lender. So there are a few certified CDFI banks and credit unions, but few and far between. For the most part, CDFIs are just revolving loan funds, non-depository revolving loan funds, meaning that you can't get an Occuptan debit card because we don't hold like a checking account or a saving account for you. We are just a revolving loan fund. For the most part, what the CDFI model looks like is you're a nonprofit revolving loan fund. And so whereas like banks are regulated and they have shareholders who own a portion in a bank, and it is their business goal to make money and have a profit, CDFIs are on the other side of the table because we're a nonprofit. We have a board of directors who governs us, but they're not shareholders like in a bank. So they don't receive any of the profits. And again, like I said, we're nonprofit. And we emphasize a lot of time, money, and everything on technical assistance to build our borrowers up. A lot of times we get clients who can't go to a bank, or they can't get favorable terms at a bank because they're considered a credit risk. At CDFIs, we look at risk very differently, and we understand that technical assistance and helping to empower our borrowers to make all of the right financial decisions, it it gets rid of that quote unquote risk that banks might see. So we do loans, but we also do a lot of technical assistance, a lot of helping clients understand things, a lot of, you know, helping them write business plans, helping them crunch the numbers. Whereas like a bank, you kind of just need to be credit ready. You need to be borrower ready. You need to understand all these concepts for the most part. So that's kind of the major difference. CDFIs have been around for decades, but they were formalized under the Clinton administration when we became the CDFI fund under Treasury. So that's kind of when we got like our official start, but we'd been around long before that. But under the Clinton administration is when we became like a certified full-on program under Treasury. And we've kind of just started really proliferating the United States since then. But we were created because there was this gap between like unbankable people per se and banks. And these people who, you know, didn't have the perfect credit score, but had a really good business model, and, you know, they needed access to capital to grow their business. But they weren't quite ready, according to bank standards, for access to credit. And so CDFIs were created to kind of be that middleman, to help those entrepreneurs, to help those small businesses, to help people build their credit score, to get them bankable. So we were created as like a stepping stone, is kind of one of the ways to look at it. Indian country specifically does not have a lot of traditional financial institutions playing in Indian country and giving our tribal members access to credit or fair credit. So we were also kind of how it ended up working out in Indian country was just to address those credit desert gaps and to be the lender in Indian country.
You talked a little bit about risk, and obviously that is a barrier to capital access. What are some of the other barriers to capital access that tribal citizens specifically face?
I kind of hate the word risk. I think it has detrimental meaning. And I would argue that the biggest risk in a lending deal is the lender itself, most of the time. But that's, I digress. That's a different conversation probably. But when it comes to what traditionally is looked at risk, you come down to your 5 C's of credit. And the largest of those 5 C's being cash flow, collateral, and they want to see like, you know, do you have 150% equity, or like how can we really, really secure our position as a lender? And yes, one of the 5 C's of credits is character, but that's not necessarily like the most important C to a bank, right? At CDFIs, character is one of the hugest C's at CDFIs, because we can teach financial literacy. We can teach how to read a balance sheet and put projections together, but we can't teach sweat equity, right? And so character is a huge one for us. On our risk rating sheet, we've modified it and we have sweat equity as one of our things that we look at, because we understand that, you know, we can educate, but we can't teach people how to work hard. And so in Indian country, we don't often get taught financial literacy in our schools, and it's not something that's talked about at home, because we have other fish to fry first. We have families to feed. We got to take care of our grandparents. We have, you know, family emergencies that come up, or, you know, we couldn't go to work for a week because our babysitter fell through. And so we have other irons in the fire that often take precedence over saving money for a business plan dream or something. But we've got all the sweat equity in the world. And understanding that culturally, like what is valued culturally is not what the 5 C's of credit in a bank value, right? And so we get that at CDFIs in Indian country, because, you know, at Occupon specifically, we're built by producers for producers. So we understand that, like the cultural differences that can lead to access to credit. And then when you look at another huge barrier and risk that's perceived risk is actually what I like to call it, perceived risk from a bank is our assets. So in Indian country, we generally have significantly smaller balance sheets than outside of Indian country. And the largest reason for this is because, for the most part, we lease our land from the tribe. You know, we get a range unit, so we call it in our part of Indian country. You know, we get a range unit, and that range unit might be in the family for 4 or 5 generations. But because we're leasing it from the tribe, we're paying for it, but we're never going to own it. We're never going to have it on our balance sheet. So we don't get to leverage what is normally an agriculture producer's largest asset, being their land. We never get to leverage land to be able to get access to capital. Because when you have good leverage power, when you have good assets and land appreciates, it doesn't depreciate. Banks love taking land for collateral, makes them feel very secure. They're more likely to extend you credit because it's a good long-term asset. But when you don't have that asset to leverage because you have to lease it from your tribe, because systemically this is where we've ended up in Indian country is with leases. When you don't get to do that, you don't have that leverage power, it slows your role. It slows your ability to access capital. It slows your ability to really invest in yourself. So that's one of the issues around land. The second one would be around trust land. So say, you know, you still are on your family's lot allotment, you got your 160 acres, 80 acres, 40 acres, whatever that looks like, and you do get to own land, right? A lot of times in Indian country, that land is in trust for whatever reasons. A lot of times, that's, again, a whole different conversation, but when we do own land, a lot of times it's in trust. Traditional financial institutions won't or really, really, really do not like to let you mortgage your trust land and leverage your trust land. There is a myth out there that you can't. And sometimes I feel like banks are trying to figure out how to get to no, whereas CDFIs are like, how do I get to yes? So banks are like, oh, there's this myth out there that you can't leverage your trust land. No, can't do it. Like, I'm not going to look into it. Like, it's an easy no. Or they're like, oh, you can leverage trust land. Well, we don't work with the BIA. We don't do this and that. So we're not gonna take it for collateral. You own your land, but you don't get to leverage it because of the bank landscape and what that looks like. There's issues around, you know, like title insurance. Like we have yet to find a company who will issue title insurance for trust land and all these other little things that are easy no's for a bank to get to. But CDFIs, because, you know, we're built by producers for producers, because we're familiar with working in Indian country, we understand that it is paramount to producer success that you need to leverage your asset, that you should be able to, just like everybody else. So CDFIs have actually been mortgaging trust land for years, because CDFIs, like I said earlier, we're trying to figure out how to get to yes, not trying to figure out how to get to no. We got to do our first trust land mortgage last year, and we've got a few more in the works. And it's really exciting to be able to dispel that myth and to figure out how to get to yes on those. And there's like a few little nuances, a few little extra hoops we got to jump through, but it's worth it to us. And we understand that it means the world to our producers. So we're going to keep doing it. We're going to keep taking, you know, that leap of faith and working with BIA and stuff like that to be able to mortgage your trust land. But yeah, so that's kind of some of the big issues that are access to credit barriers. It's definitely an interesting business model to see like who can do what and where. And, you know, there's downfalls to being a certified CDFI and versus a bank. Like, banks get to go to the Fed and they get to borrow more like unlimited amounts of capital, and they don't have loan limits at $250,000. And you know what I mean? So it's we partner with banks a lot, knowing that they have their strengths and we have ours, and how can we fit together, you know? It's messy, but we are happy to sift through the mess and make it clean for our producers.
So we talked about capital access issues and what these barriers are in accessing capital. What impact did those issues have on the economic development of tribal communities?
Yeah, so one of the examples that I like to share is this monopoly kind of example, because it really puts things into picture. Lakota Vogel from Four Bands Community Fund, another CDFI, was the first one that I had ever heard use this metaphor, and I've never forgot it, and I use it all the time. But I want to give credit where credit is due. So Tish, let's pretend me and you were sitting down and we're at family Thanksgiving and we're playing Monopoly. Me, you, and all the cousins. And so we're playing Monopoly, and we get to play for 3 hours, and we're going around the board. We all start at the same time, and we're going around the board and buying properties and putting up houses, hoping to get to a hotel someday, right? And then, our one cousin who's perpetually on Indian time shows up 3 hours late to Thanksgiving, because they got a flat tire and then ran out of gas. So they show up to Thanksgiving 3 hours late, and then they sit down and they want to play Monopoly with us. Well, Monopoly was not designed for people to join the party late. It was designed for us to all sit down at once. And there's no easy ins after you show up late. So our late cousin is playing on the same board as us. They technically have the same opportunities as us because they have the same access to properties as us. They get to pass go and collect $200 like us, but they are struggling. And so at 3 hours in, success to me and you is going to look like turning our houses into hotels and collecting rental income. But to them, who's joining the system, who's joining finance a little late, success to them looks like just getting around the board without going bankrupt, because the traditional financial system was not, in one, designed for Indian country to join late. Two, it was not designed with our realities in mind. Trust land, stuff like that, and it was designed for the people who originally started using finance, right? It was not designed for Indian country, who have cultural barriers around, you get your allotment and it's individual ownership, but we were accustomed to communal ownership, so we didn't understand the implications of fractionation and what that looks like. And now that we do understand, we're kind of late to the party, and we're trying to be reactive versus proactive to all these things that happen to us, and we're trying to fix them. But again, it's being reactive, right? And so our cousin who's late is being reactive to this financial economy, to this board. So sure, they have the same access to things like we do. And you can translate that into having access to the same federal programs and grant programs and things, a value-added producer grant. Sure, Tish, you and our cousin who's always late can go to the VAPG and get a grant to start a processing plant. But who do you think is going to have a better chance? The one, me and you, because the system was designed for us, right? It was not created with the realities of Indian country in mind. So now that we have set the monopoly board, let's put that into real terms for Indian country's economy. We are behind because the system was not created for us, and we joined late. So while there is this really amazing food economy renaissance going on that I love, and I love that I get to help finance some of these operations, we are still having to be really reactive to these systems that we were thrown into and stuff. So that's why I think CDFIs are great for Indian country, because we're built by producers for producers. We are in the trenches per se with our producers, so we understand, and we're willing to make these accommodations or help with financial empowerment and education to get people to that baseline, right? But that's economically, that's kind of where we're at. And we've been saying for a long time that agriculture is an underutilized economic driver in Indian country. Agriculture was the first economy. We've always needed to eat, so we've always traded. And we are always going to need to be able to eat. So investing in our agriculture is really important. The NAF, Native American Agriculture Fund, years ago, they did a study. They published a report called Reimagining Native Food Economies. And in there, they did some number crunching, and they had found that if Native agriculture had the same level of investment as Indian gaming, that the agriculture industry would actually far outpace the Indian gaming industry. It would be a larger economical driver than Indian gaming. And I think that is so exciting. We did our own market study in 2022, and about like half of the producers that we had surveyed had loans. The other half were just operating, you know, with the two pennies they can find to rub together because they don't want to, they can't play in this financial system. It wasn't made for them. But imagine if everybody had access to capital, what would that do? Instead of surviving, we would get to thrive. And there's so much potential. And I see tribes and I see Native owned organizations doing so many exciting things out there related to food security, food sovereignty, job creation, economic development, and like really trying to take more of a proactive approach to future problems instead of having to be reactive to things that have happened to us. And I just call this like food renaissance. Like we're totally switching around and we're, you know, taking our power back and investing in ourselves and doing what we need to do. And I love it. And so, you know, you can't change hundreds of years of terrible history overnight. You know, it's going to take time. Like it's not just going to be better tomorrow. But I see really positive movement into creating strong and powerful economies in Indian country, especially around agriculture, because that's like the one thing I do, right, is ag. And it makes me so excited. And I feel so fortunate to be able to get to finance some of those projects.
You guys are doing great things. How do you measure the impact of your CDFI's work in tribal communities?
Yeah, so this is kind of something we go back and forth with a lot. You know, there's your typical key performance indicators, KPIs, like impact measurements around like jobs created, jobs retained, dollars deployed, how many loans do you do, like, and kind of your typical things that, you know, we have to track as a CDFI, you know, like how much work do we do in persistent poverty counties and high poverty census tracts, and which is like all of Indian country, right? And all these things. And, you know, there's those typical indicators that we have to track. But we also recognize that, you know, we're different because we don't play on the regular Monopoly board. And sometimes success to us is just buying one house. And whereas like success for other people is turning their houses into hotels, you know? And so like, how do we measure that win when it's more like realistic for what's going on in Indian country versus like whatever, you know, the state of New York is doing or something, for example, you know? And so how do we measure kind of things like that differently? And so we've also, you know, we've got a lot of data just within our portfolio because we have to gather annual financials and different things like that. And so we've also decided that other indicators of success are how, like, what is your percentage, like your average percentage growth in equity on your balance sheet? You know, we ask our producers, what are your goals? Where do you want to be in 1, 3, 5, 10 years? And then like, what do you want to accomplish this next year? And if you accomplish your goals, that's a yes. And so, you know, like 85% of our portfolio is at a yes for accomplishing their goals or mostly accomplishing them. Like also trying to quantify some qualitative data in there too. And we're still kind of perfecting some of these systems, but we can't be prescriptive with what success looks like across the board because everybody's in a different place. So how do we catch those nuances and still tell the story? Because that number might not be super helpful. You know, like their success looks differently. In Indian country, oftentimes there's you know, maybe 2-3 generations of a family living in one house. So success for them might be earning enough income to be able to get a used trailer house to move next door on the ranch. Home ownership, that's a win. Just because it's a used trailer house doesn't mean squat. We don't get to build new stick-built homes in Indian country all the time. That's just not a reality for us. But that's still a win that needs to be celebrated, right? You know, so we do things like that. Like, has your net income increased? You know, did you get to, did your capital expenditures go up because you made extra money? And so you got to invest in equipment that's going to make your operation more effective and efficient and stuff like that. So we're also kind of, you know, still trying to figure out how to quantify some of those more qualitative things, because they're so much more excited than jobs created, jobs retained, dollars deployed, loans committed, like the regular stuff that of course is important and tells a story, but we can't be prescriptive with what success looks like across the board. So we're also really intentional about catching those other wins.
Mm-hmm. So you guys are doing amazing work. What future initiatives or goals does Occupton have to further improve capital access for tribal citizens?
Yeah, one, we just closed our pilot year, and it went from pilot idea, pilot project, to permanent initiative at Occupton is our UNYAYA grant. It's our succession planning grant. In all my travels, I go to Native Ag specific conferences, but I also just go to like ag at large conferences. So I get to see like, how does the Indian country work versus Black farmers, Latino farmers, white farmers. Like, I get to see all these different areas and industries and in lanes of agriculture. And, you know, what are wins in other areas that I can modify and bring back to Indian country and all these things. And succession planning and the positive impacts that makes on the next generations was a win that I had seen outside of Indian country that I wanted to bring to Indian country. And succession planning really is a privilege, right? When you're just trying to make it to tomorrow, or you're just trying to make it to the next year, succession planning really is a privilege. And yes, we all know it's important. We all know it's the right thing to do, but like, it just wasn't really happening in Indian country. And so I was like, okay, like, what do we need to do to really, like, what's that final kick in the pants to get our producers to do this, right? And so I'd had this idea for a supplemental program to our loans, where we could grant some dollars to our producers, and we can connect them with financial advisors, lawyers, estate planners, life insurance agents, like all these things. And we'll pay for it up to a certain dollar amount, and we will connect you with them. You just got to show up at the meetings, right? And so we got some money from NAF. They funded it. And I was very much like, I have an idea. I don't know what this is going to look like. I know there's lots of laws around it, but like, I have this idea, and it's going to be really, really instrumental and a huge game changer for these producers. And so they were like, please give us more details once you figure that out, but here's some money for your pilot round. And so I kicked it over to Justine, one of our program officers here at Occupton on the team. And she went to work. And we have a whole blog actually just released like a week or two ago on our website about the whole process. But she went to work, did a bunch of research, wrote a bunch of things down. And we have this like succession planning guide where it just goes and asks you all sorts of questions about like, why should you succession plan? And what does that mean? And like, who do you want to have your assets, and how do you want to break it down, and X, Y, Z, and they can work through that. But then she also connected our producers with estate planners and different things in their areas. And in our pilot year, we were able to support clients in obtaining 22 life insurances, 4 standalone wills, 17 trusts/estates, which combined a standalone will along with an in-depth long-term legal planning document, 23 long-term investment accounts, which is the equivalent of a retirement account. We technically legally couldn't do 401ks, and then 5 long-term tax plans just in our first year. So what this means is that when somebody wants to retire, they can retire comfortably because they have a nest egg instead of working till the day they die. And when they get to retire comfortably, they have an easier time transferring assets to the next generation. Or, you know, God forbid, in the case of your untimely departure, someone passes, you have a life insurance policy to put all your debt at the bank, which means in either situation, the next generation gets to start out with assets. They get to inherit assets. They don't get to inherit debt. And that is how we make generational impact. Occupy's work up to this point was having like immediate impact, and eventually would have led into generational impact. Like our work was really great and really important, but we wanted to be more intentional with our generational stuff to have a deeper impact. And so now we're like double duty hitting that impact with our producers, and we're doing it in more than one way, and it's so exciting. And so we just closed our pilot year. We're going to open our second year, and this will be a longstanding initiative that occupies to get our producers access to these succession planning tools, research, professionals, whatever they need, so that they can do this at their operation.
Well, and I feel like this goes back to your Monopoly analogy, where you're almost like reversing time and making sure that your cousin gets there 2 hours late instead of 3 hours late.
Yeah. We're like, how can we, you know, instead of taking baby steps to catch up, how can we take leaps, you know? And this is one of those, by, you know, just kind of providing that missing piece from making succession planning a privilege to just a normal practice with our producers.
Skaya, this has been a great episode. We really appreciate you coming on the podcast and really bringing us a bunch of information about CDFIs. Thank you so much again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to talk egg and access to capital, financial education, and all the fun extra things that we need to do. So.
We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of Rooted Wisdom and that you now have a better understanding of the challenges and successes of credit access in Indian country. If you would like more information about Occuptan, or if you'd like to support IFAI, please see the show notes. As always, stay rooted in wisdom.